WHFR.FM. We're making waves.
Take charge of your college experience. The HFC Student Activities Office can help you connect with or start a club, plan and promote events or fundraisers, or even find volunteer opportunities in our community. The HFC Student Activities Office operates 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Thursday in the fall and winter semesters, and 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Thursday in the summer semester. You can find the HFC Student Activities Office on campus in the M Building, or call 313-845-9865. That's 313-845-9865.
From the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn, featuring local and independent artists. Up and coming next is the WHFR Journal.
This is the WHFR Journal on 89.3 FM, or perhaps you're listening on the web at WHFR.FM. Either way, glad you're here on this, the 24th day of the month of May. We are celebrating a Memorial Day weekend. We wish you a safe, happy, and healthy holiday weekend. If you're going to be doing some traveling, we hope it is, again, a safe journey to get to your destination. And we wish you all the best. Hopefully you're celebrating with family, friends, and just appreciate a little bit of downtime in this summer season here in Metro Detroit. We thank you for tuning in to this edition of the Journal. In our first half of today's program, we're going to be hearing from an event that took place on Friday, May 10th at Fellowship Hall Christ Episcopal Church at Military in Cherry Hill, and this is here in Dearborn. This is a free public event that took place, and it relates to the topic of censorship in education. So this was a free public event aimed to raise awareness about educational policy and the effects of censorship. A panel of local representatives and educators discussed their experiences and their perspectives on the recent events related to censorship in education, particularly here in Metro Detroit and Dearborn. The hope was to create a respectful environment that ensures that all participants felt valued and heard, fostering some open dialogue and active listening. And I believe that the session did just that. So scheduled speakers included representative of the 15th District Aaron Burns, student researcher Zina Al-Jahawi, and Dearborn librarian Nicole Allward, and others. When you listen to it, we will hear the beginning opened up by Alicia Mazurek, who is involved as co-president of the League of Women Voters, Dearborn Heights. This event is sponsored by the League of Women Voters, Dearborn Heights. So we look forward to playing about a third of that for today. And we will be airing the rest of the event next week on the Journal on the 31st of May. But wanted to sort of kick that off with some discussion on censorship in education. And then to honor the Memorial Day weekend holiday, I located just a beautiful story called Bracelets of Grace, the Vietnam War story of Major Stanley Horn. This is a piece from Public Radio Exchange from actually about 13 years ago. It speaks to Memorial in conjunction with the Vietnam War, talks a bit about protests, but all kind of centered around Major Stanley Horn, his lovely wife and family, and some very special ways they celebrated and honored the legacy of Major Stanley Horn. Again, Bracelets of Grace, the Vietnam War story of Major Stanley Horn, will be our second feature on today's program. We hope that you will enjoy this holiday weekend, and we thank you for taking us along with you wherever you go and whatever you do. So thanks for being with us today. We will kick things off again with Censorship in Education, a panel discussion that took place Friday, May 10th, right here in the Dearborn community.
Hello, everyone. Welcome, everyone. Good
Good evening. I'm Alicia Mazurek, and I, along with Jennifer Oliver, we are the co-presidents of the League of Women Voters of Dearborn and Dearborn Heights. The League is a nonpartisan national organization that encourages the informed and active participation of citizens in government. The League never supports or opposes political candidates or parties. Membership is open to everyone age 16 years and older, and the League of Women Voters wants every eligible voter to be informed and to vote. This program is presented and produced as a public service by the League of Women Voters. So welcome everyone. This event is being recorded. Wanted to let you know that we're recording it because we have a YouTube channel, and we would like to post this on our YouTube channel so people who are not able to have been attending here tonight can watch it. So with that, I did want to, before I turn it over to our distinguished and knowledgeable panelists, I wanted to let you all know that the League of Women Voters does have a public position regarding public libraries, and I'm going to read it. This is from the League of Women Voters of Michigan. It's social policy positions, and in part, the policy reads, the League supports full-service public library systems. A, public libraries should support our First Amendment right to intellectual freedom and expression by playing an important role in facilitating free and open access to information. B, individuals should be trusted to make their own decisions about what they read and believe. Removing and banning books from public libraries is a slippery slope to governmental censorship and the erosion of our country's commitment to freedom of expression. And C, library staff operating within the standards of the American Library Association should make professional decisions about selection, organization, preservation, and dissemination of resources, services, and technologies without political interference. With that, I'm going to turn it over to our panel. But please note, our external speakers this evening do not speak on behalf of the League of Women Voters of Dearborn and Dearborn Heights. The views expressed at this event are not necessarily aligned with those of the League of Women Voters. And with that, I am going to turn it over to one of our panelists, Zena Sattar. She's a student researcher at University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, and she's going to kick off the panel discussion and introduce our other wonderful panelists. So, Zena, thank you.
Good evening, everyone. Like Alicia mentioned, my name is Zena Jidehawi. I'm a student researcher at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. I've been researching book banning for the past 3 years, and under my religious studies mentor, Dr. Joel Gaffin. I was appointed by Secretary Benson in 2023 to lead a task force of 34 colleges and universities for student voting rights. The reason why I wanted to organize this event with the League of Women Voters is because the majority of book ban efforts today are not spontaneous, organic expressions of citizen concern. Rather, they represent and reflect the effort of multiple advocacy organizations in order to censor certain ideas and materials. And unfortunately, these organizations have been very successful in their efforts. The Bible got banned in Utah. Stories about Native Americans have been removed from libraries. Narratives about immigrants have been exorcised from our libraries. And unfortunately, many more censorship efforts by these organizations, which is why I wanted to do a panel about it tonight. And I'm very grateful that our amazing panelists have agreed to talk about it tonight. And I will hand it over to them to introduce themselves.
Thank you, Zena. I'll step over here if that works. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening. Good evening.
We'll try it one more time. Good evening.
Good evening.
There we go. I know it's Friday evening. It's been a long week. We're so thankful that y'all are here with us. A huge thank you to Zena and the League of Women Voters, my fellow panelists, for being here this evening. My name is Erin Burns. I serve as a state representative for House District 15, which encompasses the west end of Dearborn and all of Dearborn Heights except for Precinct 8. And I'm really honored to be here tonight. Of course, we've seen, sadly in our local community, along with the national landscape over the past few years, a rise in these conversations about censorship and banning books. It's definitely been heartbreaking for me to see, but it's also been, I think, an opportunity for folks who want to stand up against censorship and want to see access to books really exercise their freedom of speech and really demonstrate their beliefs. And I'm one of those people. I've been working with a lot of great folks in our community over the past few years to really stand up against this book banning movement. And I think it's so important to have access to information and accurate information. That's really critical. We know sometimes that people today tend to be kind of fact averse, and we really have to kind of rail against that. So I think this is a great way to do that. And I'm just honored to be here with everyone tonight. I look forward to the discussion, and I will pass it over.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for attending this evening and for listening to us talk about this crucial subject pertaining to libraries and education and the impact that it may have on our current life as well as the future. It's something that's very passionate to me because I've been a lifelong reader, and it's something that sort of drew me to libraries and librarianship in itself is because I do think that there needs to be people who are willing to put themselves forward to talk about these critical issues that are about our rights in an appropriate way and to lead by example. So I hope to do that in my role as the library director of the Dearborn Public Library System. And I hope that as you guys get to know me in the city, that you're willing to come and talk to me about any issues that you see with our system or ways that we can improve service and access and information. So again, Betty Adams with the Library of Dearborn, and I'm gonna pass it on.
Hi, I'm Nicole Allward. I am the school librarian at Edsel Ford High School, and I'm the Dearborn Public Schools resource teacher for libraries, which means I work with all the librarians and with all the different schools. After last year, I've now become kind of a subject matter expert in book challenges because we kind of faced everything in Dearborn. So I've actually had a chance to work with a lot of other librarians in the state to help them work on their policies and how to navigate the, you know, the current climate. And also I got to talk to so many people, I learned so much that they made me the Michigan School Librarian of the Year. So after all that, they were like, oh, she actually knows what she's doing. So glad to be here. I am always willing to talk to people about this subject because I always want people to avoid, you know, the emotional impact that we had last year. All right, thank you.
Thank you so much to our amazing panelists. I will get started with our questions. My first question for tonight is, in what ways might book banning and censorship affect students' educational development and critical thinking?
Up
to you.
Okay. I don't know, I think maybe Nicole.
Okay. It'll reach.
Okay. I thought the statement that the league has on censorship was, you know, spot on with its stance on book banning. How it affects students is if you are in those groups that the challenges are saying these shouldn't be in the library, that is so harmful that it, you know, I felt like it kind of crushed some people's spirits because they would come in and they're like, well, I heard you can't have any books that, you know, have LGBTQ characters anymore. And I was like, that's not what happened, but that's what they believed happened because that's what they saw on all of the signs. And so I feel like we had to kind of do some work is to make sure people knew everyone is still welcome in the library and that we have those things. And we want to make sure at the library that kids have a way to learn about all of these aspects of society and other cultures, and we don't want to exclude anyone. So I think taking those out with the message of that it protects children is harming them. I'll go next. So with education and children, part of one of the most important things about childhood is their discovery. And the way that they discover things is almost through osmosis. It's not monkey see, monkey do necessarily, but it's you see a child engaging in nature, they're going to learn something from that, whether you realize it or not. And so for me, it seems naive to try to remove information from these discovering minds at any age, because you're limiting their abilities and you're handicapping them unnecessarily so. By your own fears is usually what it comes from. These are often emotional calls if they're not organized by larger institutions. It's oftentimes an emotional situation where it is competing with ethical or religious beliefs that are built in the home. But the home is not the community. The home is a part of the community. And the goal of the library in any institution, whether public or educational, is to provide for that whole constituency that come in through those doors. One of the key differences between educational and public libraries is this key terminology that's Latin and loco parentis. And in public libraries, this is part of why some of these will impact schools much greater than they'll impact public libraries, and why it'll dissipate in public libraries faster. And loco parentis is, when you sign for your student to go to school, you are giving them permission to act as a parent on your behalf. Public libraries, that is not the case. So you, as a citizen of this country, have the right to come into this library and use it. We cannot restrict you. So that's one of the key things, just with these informations, and it may not be even misinformation, it's just not knowing that key difference between our institutions, but we're still unified with the key message of providing information and not limiting people based on their discoverability or based on their interests and their impact therein.
Thank you both for that perspective.
Thank you so much. So I think definitely there are a variety of ways in which, you know, censorship and book banning can impact children's education. I'll start with a negative way, and then I'll also share, I think, a positive way, if there's a positive to be found here. So I think on the negative end of the spectrum, of course, you know, there are some states throughout the country, Michigan is not one of them, but there are some states where they are literally changing history, right? They're rewriting history. Folks may have heard that in some states, the story of Rosa Parks refusing to give up her seat on the bus is being reframed and totally whitewashed, and I use that term intentionally, and they're essentially teaching children that she just didn't want to give up her seat. She was just being obstinate, right? When we know, I saw an eye roll in the back, yes, like roll your eyes to the heavens on that one. It's unbelievable, right? And it's so insulting. We know that Rosa Parks was a trained activist. We know that the reason she didn't give up her seat on the bus was because she was fighting and rallying against this racist treatment, this segregation. This is so important. In Florida, got to reference Florida in this conversation, you know, they're looking at taking, and they may have already, when they talk about slavery, they're not even referring to it as slavery. They're referring to it as, I think, an apprenticeship. Right? It's unbelievable. It's just, I'm at a loss for words for how to even describe it. It just, it's horrendous, and it's racist, right? And so that's at the core of a lot of this. I think there's a lot of racism, a lot of toxic masculinity, all of these really, you know, unfortunate elements combined to create this kind of toxic stew that we see. So in some cases, on the negative end of the spectrum, book banning literally results in the rewriting and the whitewashing, quite literally, of history, which is horrendous and tragic. On, I think, a more positive note, I will say, if there is a positive to be found, I think book banning and censorship conversation has done just that, right? It started a conversation. And, you know, a lot of the books that some folks would seek to ban from school or public libraries sometimes are books that we find, ironically, no one ever even had checked out, right? They were there on the shelves, no one had checked them out yet. But now you can bet they're a hot ticket item, right? Somebody wants to ban this book. If you're a 13, 14, 15-year-old, somebody tells you don't do it, what are you going to do, right? We've all been there. So I think that is, right? And that's a positive thing, I believe, because it sparks interest and it sparks questioning and conversation. Why is this book something that some folks, not all, but some folks are seeking to ban? What's in this book? Who is this book about? That's really important. So again, if there's a positive to be found, mm-hmm. I think that's it. Yeah.
Thank you. And yeah, reading is cool again. My next question for my panelist is, how do you balance the need to protect intellectual freedom and community concerns about content? And I will let whoever wants to take this question.
I'm going to unwrap it here.
Oh, yeah.
Anyone else being bothered by this? I got you. Don't worry. There we go. We're all set.
So this one's actually interesting for me because just before I left my previous position, I took the intellectual freedom chair for the state of North Dakota libraries because in 2023 they were trying to change the House Bill 1205. They were trying to change how we classified books and how we defined obscenity. What we use is called the Miller's Test, and it was set long before my time by, was it the Supreme Court? It's an institutional thing that I just now know about. However, it is a three-pronged test that is very, very detailed in how you come to determine if something is obscene or not. It stood, tested, tried, true. It's what we've used. North Dakota was changing it from the language of general population levels of intelligence to a minor. And what I had provided to them was the end result of doing something like this is that all of the books in the library, because we are every area of the library is publicly available, we will not restrict a children's section from people going in it, and we will not restrict an adult section from children going in it. That removes the public part of the public library. So by doing this, you are removing all of the materials above a baby level of education or information, because that's the ultimate goal that would end up if somebody followed it through to the T of what was written. Fortunately, they adjusted some of the language, and it wasn't to that effect, but it still references the Miller's Test with the minor instead of the general public. So even our legislatures who are in place, me as a librarian trying to say, this is how we actually do this, and them not understanding even what is already in place that we follow is a challenge as well. So having our representatives available to us to hear and to participate in these conversations is also essential to continuing to have this advocacy available to the institutions. So that's intellectual freedom in general. Big thing for me.
One of the things in the school system, what you kind of touched on, is that we do have different grade levels and we have very specific purchasing guidelines for each grade level. And last year, there was a lot of misinformation about what we were purchasing for elementary schools, for middle schools. So we've had to try and communicate with the public more about what we have in each school, because we had the opt-out form and parents would fill it out for their elementary school child and say, I don't want them to have access to pornography. And we were like, well, lucky for you, you don't have any. And what we would do sometimes is we would invite the parent to come in and look at the library, and we would, and then they would come in, they're like, this is not what I was told was here.
Right.
And then they were very comfortable with their child using the library. We have had very few people actually use that opt-out. And so we're trying to invite people to come in a positive way. We have a lot of conversations with students who will come up to a book with a book and say, this shouldn't be in the library, this is inappropriate. And then it's an opportunity for us to say, if you're uncomfortable with this picture or this book, you don't have to check it out. Sometimes they're very silly. We had a nursery rhyme book where the back of the shirt had it was like an old timey dress shirt that had a split in the back. And he was like, it looks like a butt. And so,
Miss Mary Mack.
It was nursery rhymes. And it was just that he was like, I need to take this to the principal. This should not be in the library. So we have a lot of those conversations with students about You know, if you think that's true and you don't like that, well, let's get a different book. And so we're hoping that building those positive relationships, you know, can help people understand the role of the library more, because we do have very strict guidelines for what we can purchase for each grade level.
So I love what Betty and Nicole said, and I think, you know, when we talk about balancing intellectual freedom and community needs, it really is about front-loading people with actual facts, right? Like legit information. Here's what the library does. Here's how we purchase books. Here are the guidelines. Here's what's in the library. I think inviting parents, guardians, adults in the home, inviting them into the library spaces is really important. It's a critical part of their child's education. And I think it's important for folks to have a sense of what is really going on. Because oftentimes we see when folks are exposed to reality, a lot of these misnomers, a lot of this hateful rhetoric starts to fall away, right? They see what is or what is not in the library, what is age and grade level appropriate, and they also get a chance to meet school or public librarians. And this is really important, right? Humanizing people and getting a sense of what is really available is important. And I would say, I know the opt-out form or opportunity was mentioned. I do think if an adult in the home, whether that's a parent or a guardian, hears of a book or thinks that a book might be available in a school or public library, they might look at it and say, you know what, I haven't had a chance to talk to my child about the content in this book or this type of story or this type of lived experience, and I want to be the one to have that conversation with them first. That's okay, but again, that's a conversation I think that needs to be had, because kids have so much access to information. And what I always find interesting about this conversation about books is that we also have the internet, right? So like, books are phenomenal. I was just at one of the Dearborn Heights libraries today. I'm an avid patron of our local libraries, and there's nothing like reading, like having a book in your hand, right? But there's also so much other information out there and ways to access information. And I think we need to be aware of that. Books are not the only space where you might hear something, read something, come across something. Whether you think it's good or bad, whether you think it's age appropriate or not, there's a variety of spaces where folks get information. I think the internet is actually far more dangerous because it is so, you know, just like the wild, wild west, or we're in Michigan, so the wild, wild Midwest for us. But it's just, you know, there's so much out there. So I think it really is about teaching young people how to think critically, because they are going to come across so much information. And if we're not having these conversations with them from the start and really valuing their intellect, that's where I think we run into problems. So I think it's just about treating kids with respect and engaging them in those conversations in ways that adults in the home think are appropriate.
Yeah, thank you. To add what you were saying, Nicole, there are a lot of misconceptions about what happens in libraries. One example, in Idaho, I've been studying book banning throughout the United States, and one example was in Idaho. A library that won Library of the Year, very beloved by local residents, had a group of anti-book banners show up with a list of 33 books demanding the librarian remove them and demanding the librarian's resignation if she didn't. The thing is, the library never had those books in the first place. And 33 titles were asked to be removed, and she said, I can't remove them because they don't exist. So that is, and that's actually one of the very popular mechanisms that people who are involved in book banning do. They don't need to read the book. There are websites like BookLooks, which is a tool that basically creates a censorship scale for certain materials. If a book is really bad, BookLooks can say, this book needs to be removed. And these organizers use BookLooks to go to libraries and say, we need this material removed. They don't need to read it because BookLooks said it was bad.
We will stop our panel discussion at this point. Again, Censorship and Education, a discussion panel that took place Friday, May 10th at Christ Episcopal Church here in Dearborn, sponsored by the League of Women Voters, Dearborn, Dearborn Heights. There's about an hour left in that panel discussion. We will share it for you next Friday in its entirety on the 31st of May on that edition of the Journal. We leave you now this Memorial Holiday weekend with a poignant segment called Bracelets of Grace, the Vietnam War war story of Major Stanley Horn. We wish you a lovely holiday weekend. Thank you for listening to the WHFR Journal, and stay with us. More great things to come after this segment and throughout the entire weekend right here on WHFR Radio.
Hi, honey. I'm sorry I didn't get around to writing sooner, but it's been a real busy long trip.
In the summer of 1967, U.S. Air Force Major Stanley Horn left his home in Madison, Wisconsin, on his way to Thailand and Karat Air Base. He would be stationed there as the pilot of an F-105 Thunder Chief, a supersonic tactical fighter bomber. His mission would be to drop bombs on targets in North Vietnam.
It really kept us busy since we left San Francisco.
This tape, the one you're hearing now, is one of dozens of reel-to-reel tapes Major Horn recorded and sent home to his wife, Jerry. And in Madison, Jerry Horn recorded her own.
This is Monday, and the kids have gone back to school after a nice but rather uneventful weekend. The weather is beautiful here.
Anyway, I guess I should start at the beginning and tell you what's happened. I recorded this whole message once.
Major Horn was a veteran pilot. He volunteered for the war in Vietnam, but had never before seen combat.
Really, a very, very lonely assignment. It's not like it was in Alaska, you know, when I went up there. It was lonely there, too, but I know it wasn't for very long. Here, I know it can be up to a year, and it's been 1 month today that I left.
In 1967, Major Stanley Horn and his wife, Jerry, were raising a family. They had three sons and a daughter. Jeff, 9 years old, Susan, six, Scott, three, and Kevin, just a year old.
Now remember, this is all new to us, so don't expect too much. We have been practicing, but
as the wife of a military officer, Jerry Horn knew her role and played it well. She ran the household, cared for the four young children, managed their lives while her Air Force husband flew missions over North Vietnam.
The mailman was just here, and my morale is good for another day. I got another letter from you. And in your letter, you mentioned that it's been quite a while since you've heard from me. Well, honey, I have been writing, but maybe not often enough.
These tapes passed halfway around the world, back and forth regularly for several months. But as each of the tapes arrived in Madison from the airbase in Thailand, there was more evidence of a changing man, the incremental signs of a soldier being altered by warfare.
I haven't spoken to you very much in this vein lately, Jerry. But what we're doing right now is almost impossible to believe. We're going in mission after mission. There's two missions a day and day after day. And losing from 2 to 4 airplanes every time we go in, 20 airplanes at a time.
In November of 1967, Major Horn's squadron was experiencing big losses. Men they knew, lived with, flew with, were dying.
We've lost 20 air crews in less than 6 weeks. And we, of course, can't keep this up. The loss ratio is just astronomical. That's one-third of our squadron in 6 weeks.
On January 14th, 1968, Major Stanley Horn left the U.S. Air Base in Karat, as he had done many times, piloting his F-105D single-pilot Thunder Chief.
Maybe I'm just one of the luckier people. But I'm going to come out of this, and I know it.
On this morning, the mission would again be over Vietnam, as it had always been. But this time, at a point on the Red River near the city of Yen Bay, Major Horn's plane would be shot down.
I regret the people, the friends that I lose. It's making an entirely different man out of me, watching this go on. And like everybody else, I don't know, you know, how long can it go on?
Major Stanley Horn was 41 years old.
Please don't worry about us. We are all just fine and getting along fine, too. It does get pretty lonely without you, but I try to keep as busy as I can. And so far, I've had no trouble on that score. Kevin sees to that. But it's not just him. the others keep me busy too, and then there's always the little things that come along to fill my days, things that probably you would be taking care of if you were here. But honestly,
Jerry Horn remembers the day she received the word.
Well, you know, somebody comes to your door. Yeah, comes to your door, and they have things in their hand, papers and things, and I don't know. I guess I just was thinking, I don't know what this is about, you know. And he pretty much just got right into it because there's no way you can, you know, make it an easy thing. And I'm sure it was hard for him to do, but it was a shock. It was a shock. I couldn't believe what I was being told.
I was one of the strike pilots in a formation of probably 16 airplanes. Stan was the number two airplane, flying a D model, a single-seat airplane.
Captain Earl Henderson was one of Stanley's best friends. He was in the same squadron, the 469th, and on the same mission, a mile away in his own F-105, the day Major Horn's plane was shot out of the sky.
And a MiG-21 comes swooping down out of high altitude, probably doing 1.2, 1.3 Mach. And, of course, the guy, the MiG pilot, fires an ATOL missile with a perfect solution from 6 o'clock. The missile impacts his airplane. The airplane starts coming apart, and Stan ejects immediately. And as I'm headed home, it within a few minutes, it's obvious that Stan's airplane is the one that's down. And of course, I'm just absolutely devastated because I know it's Stan, and I just can't believe it's happened.
Scotty just woke up from his nap, and he's standing next to me. He says he wants to say something to you. We tried to get him to say something on some of our practice tapes, and he wouldn't. But maybe he will now. Let's see. Just a minute now.
Hi there. Hi. How are you, Dad?
What have you been doing lately?
Knowing my husband, I just thought he will come back. If anybody could, he will.
Mm-hmm.
And I really thought that he would.
Where's Daddy?
He's on the trip.
Yes, and how long is he going to be gone, do you know?
3 days.
No, he's going to be gone a little longer than that. How long do you think Daddy's going to be gone?
It's going to be longer than that.
Yes, it sure is, isn't it? But we think about it.
As of this moment, we don't know what we're fighting, and this is part of a warfare. But we will figure it out. And we'll lose some more airplanes before we do. It won't be me. Don't worry.
Months went by. No more news. Nothing more about Stanley Horn. He was officially listed by the military as missing in action. In 1968, the days and weeks came and went. Children's birthdays came and went. The war continued. Martin Luther King was assassinated. Robert Kennedy was gunned down. Protesters against the war were beaten by Chicago police outside the Hilton Hotel, where the Democratic National Convention was held.
Americans wouldn't fight no more war!
And then a new year, 1969. And thousands of miles from where Major Horn's aircraft was intercepted by a North Vietnamese fighter pilot, two young California girls were meeting with a number of women whose husbands were listed as missing in action by the U.S. government.
It's sort of an unlikely story and so much by accident.
Carol Bates Brown, along with her friend Kay Hunter, had been part of a campus organization called Voices in Vital America, a group Carol says was trying to do positive things at a time when campuses were fertile ground for unrest.
We also had a friend, was Bob Dornan, who was a local television personality in Los Angeles at the time. He later went on and served many years in Congress. Anyway, he introduced these women, and he had a bracelet he had gotten from the Montagnards in Vietnam. And he said he was wearing that to remember what the people of Vietnam were going through at the time with the war all around them. And my friend and I decided it'd be really cool if we could get Montagnard bracelets to wear to remember the men who were POWs and MIAs. And, of course, you had to go to Vietnam sort of to get a Montagnard bracelet. We tried to figure out ways to do that. Nobody wanted to send two, you know, sorority girls to Vietnam in the middle of the war. So we decided we would maybe look into making our own.
Carol and Kay were able to persuade friends to donate metal, and they found an engraver
who did mainly horse jewelry, you know, the fancy silver for horses that are in parades and all. And he made these bracelets for us, these little test bracelets, and he engraved the names. And the original bracelets just had the name, rank, and date of loss on them. At the time, it didn't occur to us to put anything more on it, and it just really took off. Maybe other kids at school would want to wear them. And like I said, it went from just the two of us wanting to have bracelets into something where I think we distributed 5 million bracelets between 1970 and 1975.
On Veterans Day in 1970, the official bracelets were released. And etched on one of them was the name Major Stanley Horn, U.S. Air Force, January 14th, 1968. In the early going, it's not clear how many of the Horn bracelets were made and distributed, but people had them and wore them, including his fellow squadron pilot Earl Henderson and Stanley's wife, Jerry.
It was our way of remembering our husbands and waiting for them to come back and being sure that they were going to come back because we were wearing their bracelets. And, you know, we all pretty much did it.
For Jerry, who after more than a year had little else but the harsh reality that Stanley had been shot down, the bracelet was a symbol of faith, a bracelet of grace.
I actually felt like I saw the hope in that bracelet. If I kept wearing it, he would come back. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think a lot of people felt that way about their bracelets.
In the air war, American planes shot down the communist MiG over North Vietnam, the 18th of the war. The Defense Department today released...
Beginning in 1967, news of the war in Vietnam was nearly always the lead story on the nightly evening news.
In South Vietnam, there were 15...
By 1970, the war dominated American life, avoiding its costs at home and in Southeast Asia were nearly impossible.
In Gia Dinh, a grenade was thrown into a Jeep and five Americans were hurt.
And at the same time in California, Carol Bates Brown, a student at Cal State Northridge, and her friend Kay Hunter at UCLA had an engraver friend make 10 sample POW MIA bracelets.
Because they had a name on them, it gave you this one-to-one connection.
They were quickly finding out how popular their bracelets were becoming.
And people really, really connected with that. And, you know, they said, oh, my guy. They would refer to him as my guy.
Carol and Kay needed to fund the bracelet idea. They asked Ross Perot, the millionaire businessman from Texas, but nothing ever came of it. They even visited Howard Hughes in Las Vegas. Nothing there. Then the husband of a friend, sympathetic to the cause, donated brass and copper, enough to make 1,200 bracelets.
And then people like Sonny and Cher went on their television show one day and showed their bracelets.
Well, I don't know. Well, that's true.
We'd had other people on television shows showing their bracelets too, but certainly they caught the attention of the younger people.
They sold them for $2.50. That meant money coming in now. And after they officially kicked off the bracelet program on Veterans Day, November 11, 1970, more donors offered money to help. And soon Carol and Kay were receiving 12,000 requests for the bracelets every day.
We had a little office to begin with, but we outgrew that office and we had to hire a lot of people, including a lot of grown-ups. But one of the biggest things was we actually forwarded all this mail to the families. We had 10 or 15 people that did nothing but forward mail every day from bracelet wearers to the families.
And some of that mail was getting to Jerry Horn.
It gave me more hope. You know, if they supported him, I mean, maybe there was a chance that he would be back And I really counted on that.
The letters from those wearing Major Horn's POW MIA bracelet came frequently, and Jerry read every one, many times over, and kept them all together safe in a drawer in her bedroom. They came from all over the country. Teresa Mapes of Carthage, Illinois. Jenny Light of Weston, Connecticut. Michael Jones of Patriot, Indiana. Mrs. Janet Davis of Southern Pines, North Carolina. Judy Skei of Syracuse, New York. Debbie Crane of Glendale, Arizona. As more bracelets were distributed, more letters came, including one from 15-year-old Allison McIntosh of Hollis, New York, in Queens.
To the family of Major Stanley Horn, the POW MIA bracelet with Major Horn's name on it is proudly worn by me, Allison McIntosh. I have worn his bracelet for almost a month now, and I can say I am proud of him and what he has done.
Allison now lives in the Catskill Mountains, and like so many others, still has her bracelet. During a recent talk over Skype, she held it in her hand and smiled when she spoke of those letters she sent to Jerry Horn almost 40 years ago.
I remember I wore it every day. I mean, the inside of this has a little, not rust, because they're made quite well, but you can tell that the inside band here is a little worn off. I remember wearing it every day, every day. And he became my soldier.
I had gotten a lot of nice letters from people and very encouraging, and I could tell they actually believed what they were saying in their letters.
For reasons Jerry Horn can't explain, Allison's letters stood out from the rest. And although Jerry wrote return thank you letters through VIVA, the organization representing the bracelets and the families, to nearly all the bracelet wearers who mailed letters to her, there was something about Allison's letters that prompted a back-and-forth exchange, lasting for more than a year.
I do remember her letter and her telling me all about him and the family. And I can't believe, I don't even remember that I wrote that many times. And my handwriting was a lot better then.
One letter, 6 pages, single-spaced and handwritten, addressed to Allison's home, was never sent. Nearly 40 years later, Allison finally was able to read that letter.
Dear Allison, I can't possibly put into words how happy and how grateful I was to receive your letter. I have shared it with my children and other members of my family, and they have all asked that I extend their thanks to you for writing.
She really personalized the letter. I mean, she took the time, you know, in all the things that she had to do with her kids and worrying about her husband not being there, she took the time to write an extensive letter to me and detail out every, you know, different parts of what they were doing and how they were feeling. And it really, you know, I could see a connection with it even more now, being an adult. It brought me into what their life was, and it must have been pretty crazy at that time.
Please remember to say your prayers every day for Stanley. I know it will help. Thank you again, Allison, for taking the time to care.
It's terrible to feel alone in a situation like this. So it was nice. That was really good. Keep in touch in that way.
Yes, I was always hoping that possibly she was going to, you know, send me another letter saying that he was home. I remember always waiting to see, get that letter and say, oh, he's home with his kids now. But, of course, that didn't happen for a lot of them.
Allison now keeps a copy of the unsent letter next to her bracelet. And Jerry Horn, despite dozens of letters and the bracelets she and each of her children were wearing, for months and years, there was still no news on her husband. After the official release of the POW MIA bracelets, the country was becoming increasingly aware of the depth of the missing and captured in Vietnam. And on January 18, 1970, Jerry Horn was the subject of a story in the Wisconsin State Journal newspaper entitled A New Kind of Unknown Soldier. But this was Madison, Wisconsin, the home of the University of Wisconsin, a campus that had been shaken by student protests, some violent. The tension prompted the newspaper to disguise Jerry Horn's identity, using fictitious names throughout the story.
I was very careful about who knew my situation and who didn't, because I didn't want to open myself up for any harassment.
In Madison at the time, a military family could have been targeted.
So I was very careful about what I said and to whom I said it.
Then, months later, from the depths of military intelligence, a sliver of hope, word that Major Stanley Horn just might be alive.
There was a thing called a tactical analysis bulletin that came out like once a month out of Langley. And they had a section on POWs, and suddenly his name showed up in the category of probable POW.
Major Horn's friend and fellow squadron pilot, Captain Earl Henderson.
And until that time, I had always mentally carried him in the MIA category. And so I called Langley and I said, is this accurate? Is this correct? And I talked to the sergeant, and I'm on a secure line. And he says, well, yes, of course. And I said, well, the family has no idea about this. And he said, oh, you can't tell the family. I said, this is highly classified and blah, 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 blah. And I said, well, this is it's for damn important, you know. And so he cautioned me. And I thought about it quite a bit. And so I ended up calling Jerry. And I said, Jerry, you know, I think I've got some good news. I said, I just read a report that says Stan is a probable POW. God almighty, I wish I'd never made that call.
It's Christmas. I'm lonely. Unhappy at being here alone. Wish so much that I was home with you. You can't even imagine.
This reel-to-reel tape of the many Major Horn sent home to Madison was one of the last.
Those Christmas cards were tremendous. The ones with the picture of the children. Jeff looked so much bigger.
Years later, his children listened to many of these tapes for the first time. The youngest son, Kevin.
It's really emotional. It really is. I couldn't believe that I actually heard my father say my name and say that. I've never heard that in my life, and here I am 43 years old.
The one of Scott and Kevin is outstanding. My gosh, he's grown so much I couldn't believe it.
Listening to these tapes reminded the children of those days of waiting for news on their father and how important their POW MIA bracelet was to each of them.
Mom sent away, got a shipment of five or six of the bracelets.
Jeff is the oldest of the three sons.
When she gave them out, I think we all started wearing them.
The children also remember the letters that kept coming for several years from all those who wore their father's bracelet. This is Susan.
I remember, you know, quite a few of them, but I seem to remember there being quite a few more. But I just remember stacks of them.
Wow. And what do you remember your mother doing with them? Do you remember her sitting at the table?
Yeah. I remember opening them. I remember her writing back to quite a few. I remember her reading them to me.
And as those letters continued to be delivered to the Horn mailbox in Madison, Jerry and the family hung on to the hope that had come from Captain Earl Henderson.
To be in a category of probable POW... it generally means a human sighting.
But time kills hope. Son Kevin.
Every once in a while, we'd be notified that a report was going to be coming out or an update on the POW situation. And I remember my mom always being really hopeful to hear some kind of nugget of information or some type of evidence or something. But nothing ever came. We never, ever got a single piece of evidence of anything about my father. Nothing.
Here again is Jeff.
Yeah, there was disillusionment. Families of people who they believed to be POWs were allowed to send things to them. Box up, I'm not even sure, candy bars or things you could send. You know, the first several boxes my mom sent went over and they never heard anything. After maybe a year or so, we started getting a couple back returned.
I'm Bill Buttell, ABC News, New York. Tonight, Senator McGovern says President Nixon is taking the low road.
By 1972, there were signs the war was ending in Vietnam.
Sergeant Shriver says again... President
and in January of 1973, the Paris Peace Accords.
The following statement is being issued at this moment in Washington and Hanoi. At 12:30 Paris time today, January 23, 1973, the agreement on ending the war...
A month later, in February of 73.
The first group of American prisoners released under the Vietnam...
North Vietnam agreed to release 591 American POWs.
An opportunity to call home, to sleep in good beds, and to eat the kind of dinners never known...
But when the list of those POWs was released, the name of U.S. Air Force Major Stanley Horn was not there.
And I'll never forget it because she sat me and Scott down. She had already told Jeff. She said, "You know, I want you to know that there's a list of people coming home, and we wanted your daddy to be on that, but he's not on that list."
Through it all, even after the war was officially over, Stanley Horn's wife, children, and friend, Earl Henderson, continued to wear the Major's bracelet. And so did others all over the country. Susan Hall of Indianapolis, Indiana. Ann Coleman of Fayetteville, North Carolina. Debbie Block of LaGrange, Kentucky. Roseanne Garcia of Warwick, Rhode Island. Then in November of that year, the Defense Department, for reasons unclear, again changed the status of Major Horn, reclassifying him as missing in action.
My theory is he reached the ground alive.
Squadron colleague Earl Henderson.
And was alive for a period of time. It could have been a day, it could have been a year, who knows.
Despite the peace accords and the release of the POWs, the fighting in Southeast Asia continued. On April 30th, 1975, Saigon fell.
This is a historic moment. The arrival of the North Vietnamese regular army in Saigon, right in the middle of Saigon.
The figures marking the human cost of the war varied, but about 3.5 million Vietnamese on both sides lost their lives, nearly 2 million in Laos and Cambodia, and more than 58,000 U.S. soldiers. In 1975, it was still not clear if Major Stanley Horn was one of the dead.
That he will unconditionally hand over to the new regime.
Wife, Jerry Horn.
You have to resign yourself to the fact that this is the way it's going to be. And I think I did that pretty good.
In the mid-1980s, when the relations between the U.S. and Vietnam began to improve, the Vietnamese government began to slowly return American remains that had been collected or stored. The Horn family was contacted in April of 1990. There had been 10 sets of remains that had been turned over to the U.S. by the Socialist Republic of Vietnam.
Easter Day of 1990, Jeff called me, and he said, well, we have to talk.
Stanley Horn's son, Scott.
I just was flushed. I didn't know really what to say. It took a while for it to really sink in, you know.
And I just remember crying and completely breaking down.
It was shocking, but the only thing that mattered to me was the closure that was given to my mom.
Up until that point, she still had hope.
She sure did.
I mean, she's still, 22 years she later, she still had hope. A military wife doesn't give up hope until the body's returned.
John Pepitone reports that for his family, today's service ends years of not knowing what happened.
Hundreds came to pay tribute to the Madison pilot, who was missing in action until last April, when his remains.
This is a sad thing to, you know, you have to have a service, but it's sad and it's hard to go through. But it was nice.
There are no words of mine this morning that can reverse.
At the service, Jerry and her children wore their bracelets.
I still get it out. Every once in a while, I'll be thinking of him, and I'll wear it for a week or so. Yeah, so.
You still have it?
Yeah, I still have it. I keep it in my jewelry box.
And every so often, you do what?
Yeah, I get it out and wear it for a week or so, week or 2 weeks. I'll either just see it there, or I'll be thinking about him, or, you know, I'll just, I'll be telling a story to my kids about him or about growing up, and it just makes me think about him, and I'll just get it out and wear it.
Once again, Earl Henderson.
When I read that his body had returned in 1990, you know, that's when I took the bracelet off.
This drive from the Horn home in Madison to Roselawn Memorial Park and the crypt of Major Stanley Horn is like many you'd see in a small town, some strip malls and a church or two, a few houses. But it's a long way from the jungles of North Vietnam. More than 1,700 Americans are still listed as missing or unaccounted for from the war. And unlike the Horns, many families are still looking for closure, still wearing their bracelets. After the funeral service, Jerry Horn took off the bracelet that carried her husband's name. But she knows she'll never be without it.
They can put it in the casket with me. That would be fine, too. Just leave it on my wrist.
Mom and Dad used to argue about everything, especially about Dad's drinking. It drove me crazy. It got so bad, I couldn't do my homework. I couldn't concentrate. I absolutely refused to let any of my friends come to our house for any reason. I would have been humiliated if anyone found out how much my dad drank and how loud my mom screamed at him. My family went from totally crazy to quiet, calm, and even peaceful. The only thing that happened is my mom started going to Al-Anon family groups. Her relationship with my dad really changed. I asked mom if she would take me to her Al-Anon meetings or to Alateen. I wanted to see if I could have a better relationship with my dad. I'm sure glad I did. If someone's drinking troubling you, you might be surprised at what you can learn in an Al-Anon or Alateen family group from people just like you. Call 1-888-4-ALANON or go to alanon.org.
Hello, WHFR family. I'm June Williams, and I invite you to listen to the Culture Collections program, Saturdays from 1 to 3 p.m., right here on the station that's making waves. Join me and enjoy a musical journey of the Culture Collections, Saturday from 1 to 3 p.m., right here on WHFR FM 89.3, the station that's making waves.
And you are listening to WHFR Dearborn, 89.3 and WHFR.fm.
Listener-supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.
Traveling all the time, and that's why my